It's the Nuking Korean edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Gates of Hell, New Atheist Islamophobia, Korean War Redux, and will the real true meaning of Easter please stand up? Let's begin episode 205.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. Ethan, you'll never guess what. I heard the weirdest thing in the news the other day.
What was that?
One of the Islamic nations apparently received an apology from Israel. Did you hear about this?
No, I did not.
Well, people may or may not know, a few years ago, Israel accidentally, kind of on purpose, attacked and killed some Turkish people on a Turkish boat who were trying to get into Gaza. Diplomatic ties between Turkey and Israel just went out the window. There was really, really hostility between that. But ironically enough, apparently the Turks were sort of saying, well, we kind of really want all these Israelis in because there's a huge tourist industry. And Israel is sitting there saying, and you may not know this, but there's a bit of a kerfuffle going on in Syria at the moment.
I have heard this, yes.
Yes. So there's a lot of talk about, you know, they're needing to have some common cause and they need to descale everything. So just recently, Benjamin Netanyahu went to, told the Turkish people, we're sorry. We killed the people. We apologize for them being there. I'm sure if they, you know, they gave an apology. And so diplomatic ties are quite down. And what struck me is this, is that, you know, Israel apologizing for anything, especially when it comes to Gaza, is kind of equivalent to hell freezing over. And then I discover there's actually a connection between Turkey and hell.
Yeah. So literally speaking, the gates of hell have been discovered in Turkey. And no, that is not some sort of insult about the wonderful nation of Turkey. I'm sure it's a very lovely place. But quite literally, archaeologists have unearthed the route to the underworld, more specifically known as Pluto's Gate. And Pluto, of course, was the Greek god of the underworld. The Roman god of the underworld.
Hades was Hades.
So anyway, historic sources have located the site in the ancient Pyrrhigian city of Hierapolis, which I'm probably pronouncing wrong, which is now called Pamukkale, which I'm also pronouncing wrong.
We're used to it.
Yeah, well, again, you know, Turkey. It is described as an opening filled with lethal mephistic vapors, which is fancy talk for poison gas. So this is how Pluto's Gate was described in 24 AD. Quote, this space is full of a vapor so misty and dense that one can scarcely see the ground. Any animal that passes inside meets instant death. And this is from the Greek geographer Strabo. So the finding was made by a team led by Francisco de Adriana, a professor of classical archaeology at the University of Salento. And he conducted the extensive archaeological research at the World Heritage Site of Hierapolis 2 years ago. He's kind of a controversial figure, this guy, because 2 years ago, he claimed to discover the tomb of St. Philip, one of the 12 apostles of Jesus Christ. So, I mean, there might be a bit of skepticism flowing about any announcement this fellow has made, but nonetheless, it's still pretty darn cool. Now, these ancient ruins, which have sort of like a kind of a collapsed temple and some old columns, the damage not only comes from earthquakes, but actually, apparently, some Christians took offense to the sort of, I guess, pagan association and trashed the joint at a point in history. But they're pretty confident that this is actually the gates of hell because they've found inscriptions dedicated to the deities in the underworld, including Pluto and Kor.
Kor?
Yes.
Kor?
I guess he's some kind of underworld god of some kind.
Maybe he's the instant death of hate. Because, I mean, hell is the dead, but you have to get there somehow.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe he's like the gatekeeper of some kind. So in addition to the ruins, do you have this cave that's basically spewing out really, really toxic fumes of carbon dioxide. In fact, they even noticed that if any birds flew near the cave, they would drop dead. So it's pretty toxic. And this coincides with ancient stories about the place in that they would do animal sacrifices. They would have priests who would sort of stay close to it and have hallucinogenic visions brought about by exposure to the fumes. So it does sort of match some historic accounts of the actual gates of Hades.
So I have to ask you some questions here, Ethan.
Yeah.
And I know you haven't done extensive research on this, not being an archaeologist, not being from Turkey. I assume not being a worshiper of the Roman gods. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah.
Romantic sounds wrong, but
yeah, no, they weren't terribly romantic.
Yes. First of all, like, did they offer any pictures, anything to sort of substantiate this sort of claim?
The article that I saw was on discovery.com, and they had what was actually sort of an artist's rendition of the site. So they had a temple, some columns, and then the cave with all the smoke coming out of it. I didn't see any actual photographs, but this was recently announced, I think about 2 weeks ago, at a fairly large archaeological conference in Turkey, and I believe it was attended by some of the sort of leading Italian archaeologists of their respected field. So I'm reasonably confident this is not like a media stunt, although I think that we should always, as with any news story, retain some skepticism.
Well, that would be my next thing is like, was this actually a paper released, or was this an announcement that Discovery Channel is going to have the Gates of Hell miniseries on TV? Because Discovery Channel has been known to do some things. Also, I'm kind of curious to inquire, and again, we'll do research, maybe we'll find out. There are lots of temples to lots of gods all over the place, right? I mean,
right.
You'd have, you know, a micro temple to Athena in your household, that sort of thing. So when they say they have found a temple to Pluto, and that's the only thing we really can say, is this the one and the only temple to Pluto, or is this like one of many? Are there other deadly caves lying around other places that might, you know, fall into the same tract that would be similar?
Well, I that's entirely possible. I think what makes this particularly interesting is that, you know, this being Turkey sort of was once sort of part of that kind of Greek empire, that this is sort of where you would expect to find a physical representation of their mythology. I mean, the Greeks, keep in mind that the Greeks sort of created real-world implications for their mythologies. It wasn't quite an entirely metaphorical world. They actually had real-world correspondence to go with, you know, these famous temples, these oracles and such, right? So it does, I think, in some sense, ring true that this would be an actual physical location, and this does appear to be matching some historic documents indicate that this is where it would be. So it is kind of interesting in that respect.
Well, you know, and to be fair, I mean, you know, Turkey is a Muslim country, and as many of us know in North America, they are going to hell.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, frankly, most of us are, though.
Yes. Well, that is a weird segue into an article I came across the other day that pointed out that some members of the new atheists were, well, how should we say, a little Islamophobic. We've talked to the show before about Sam Harris, who I would say is not a little bit, but almost a proud Islamophobe, and we've discussed that sort of a few times. However, the main target of this piece seemed to be Richard Dawkins, which kind of struck me as a bit odd. Don't get me wrong, Dawkins is a sort of elderly, very British academic who has sort of the air of befuddlement about him sometimes, especially when he's talking about something that's not in his area of expertise, you know, like genetics or pure atheism. So he has said some daffer things in his day, but calling him Islamophobe strikes me as a bit of a strong statement. This latest attack is by Nathan Lien, who has made a career, if not in a bad sort of way, out of calling out what he sees as Islamophobia. He's the author of, quote, "The Islamophobia Industry, How the Right-Wing Manufactures Fears of Muslims." Now, from my research, I couldn't find anything really controversial about him. But, of course, having read the article, my opinion changed quite strongly. I mean, we have also talked, just for reference, that there does seem to be sort of a movement amongst both right-wing members of the, at least the United States, if not Canada, to promote the idea of Islamophobia. And ironically enough, among a number of fundamentalist Islamists who see it as a way to sort of gin up the troops for their own cause. See, we're being persecuted, so let's, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The genesis of the article appears to be a couple of tweets. Well, as Leanne puts it, Dawkins served up a hostile helping of snark this week aimed at the followers of the Muslim faith. He heaps false praise on them, and by them, he lumps together Dawkins, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, and once Daniel Dennett as the new atheists. So he praised them, these new atheists, for being knowledgeable, intellectual giants. And then he claims that their fame and the rise of the new atheist movement was largely because of 9/11. It strongly implies that Dawkins et al., along with evangelical pastors, owe their success to this one event, then that therein lies their sort of crusade for their own profit. And so 9/11 happens, say, hey, this is our chance. He stated that that these pastors, he does a quick jaunt at pastors, were, quote, jolted to rock star-like status, and they created megachurches. Of course, megachurches themselves were actually a 1990s phenomena. And again, he's not trying to talk about pastors in general, or Protestant evangelical pastors in general, but by making a claim against them, he's implicitly making the claim against Dawkins et al. He comments that, quote, 4 days after the tragedy, Dawkins could barely contain his intellectual triumphalism. Quote, he's quoting now Dawkins, the terrorists were not mindless and they were certainly not cowards. On the contrary, they had sufficient effective minds braced with an insane courage, and it would pay us mightily to understand where that courage came from. It came from religion. Now, remember the context of this at the time, because everyone were calling the 9/11 bombers cowards, and they were stupid people and all that sort of thing. They were duped into this, but most reports were that these were all highly educated people, and although it's crazy to do, flying a plane into a building, it's far from a cowardly thing to do. So that was sort of the context of what he was saying. He then goes on to say that Islam did not actually figure greatly in the atheist movement until 9/11, but, and again, quote, emboldened by their newfound fervor in the wake of the terrorist attacks, the new atheists joined in a growing chorus of Muslim haters, mixing their abhorrence for religion in general with a specific distaste for Islam. He then goes on to point out that Hitchens' book, God is Not Great, is a direct insult to Muslims, and I guess only to Muslims, because it's based on the common Islamic phrase, God is great. Now, of course, fair dinkum on that, right? But if you read the book, Hitchens actually goes to a lot of great length to focus on the idea of extremists of all religion. That whenever he uses an example that happens to be Islamic or Jewish, he says this happens to all ones. In fact, one of the things I thought was most interesting is that in Hitchens' books, he quite often or uniquely points out Buddhist terrorists that are quite big in places like Sri Lanka and Myanmar. So the tweet rant, quote, as Leanne had put it, said this, haven't read the Quran, so couldn't quote chapter and verse like I can for the Bible, but I often say Islam is the greatest force of evil today. To which Leanne adds the comment, I'm going to assume this is sarcastic, how's that for a scientific dose of proof that God does not exist? Which kind of strikes me as an odd comment.
That's,
to make
yeah, non sequitur right there.
The other half of the rant was Dawkins' reply to this, to a criticism that he hadn't read the Quran and still criticizes Islam by tweeting, of course you can have an opinion about Islam without having read the Quran. You don't have to have read Mein Kampf to have an opinion about the Nazis. Leanne comments on this was that, you know, he criticized Dawkins for not doing research to substantiate his beliefs, and that the hallmark of the new atheist is to, quote, insist on a conclusion before even launching into an initial investigation. So essentially the focus here is, well, you haven't read the Quran, therefore you have no right to make any comments about Islam itself, be it the religion, be it the culture, be it the society. Now, Ethan, we've often been criticized, you know, for not being, you know, being too critical about things that we haven't actually read about, right? I mean, how would you defend yourself? I mean, you haven't read the Torah. Wakefield's paper on autism, I doubt you've read that.
Yeah.
But we have often commented about that. So this idea that he's focusing on, that, well, Dawkins hasn't read the Quran, therefore shut up about Islam.
Well, I think that that's sort of... I mean, I'm sure you could make the case that that's any number of logical fallacies, because of course you don't need to read every bit of information out there to have an opinion on something. I mean, that would be like saying, for example, unless you've seen every hockey game ever, you can't be on a sports talk radio show. It doesn't hold any water. That's not how the world works. I mean, Phil Plait has not researched every single astrological phenomenon, yet he's, you know, probably an expert when it comes to things that can kill us in space. This notion that we need to have 100% knowledge before having an opinion is just, well, I think it's kind of anti-intellectual, actually.
Well, yeah, and it also goes on to the thing, too, that, I mean, and we have to be careful here, but... if Phil Plait says, you know, hey, there's this meteorite that's going to come close to Earth, you probably don't have to worry about it, right? I know Phil Plait. I know that he's done the research into this. So I have a certain degree of trust in his opinion, right? And now the minute that he says something that proves out to be wrong, I'm going to re-question that. Or I may every so often go out and do a bit more research into a particular topic. But there's enough people who have done serious scholarship into Islam, into Christianity, into Judaism, into Hinduism, into... that I don't feel that I have to have read everything that originally come out from them, as long as I am careful about the sources I choose to pick from. So now I'm kind of unsure of the belief system as Leon himself, but he does seem to have signs of intellectual dishonesty. He makes a point of stating that some, quote, detractors call Dawkins a fundamentalist, followed by a comment that, quote, Noam Chomsky is one such critic. Chomsky has said that Harris, Dawkins, and Hitchens are religious fanatics, and then quotes Chomsky as saying, they have actually adopted the state religion, one that, though void of prayer and ritual, demands that its followers blindly support the whims of politicians. So I actually checked out this particular quote, and it was a Q&A session that after one of Chomsky's numerous lectures, and what he was actually referring to was actually Harris and Hitchens, and there's no reference to Dawkins itself, and what he was doing was the fact that these particular people were supporting the Iraq war, right? It was not that they are, because they are new atheists, they are fundamentalists. It's the fact that they are actually also very right-wing conservatives, and they were supporting the Bush government at the time. That was the part that he found fanatical, not their atheism or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So again, very, quote, mining, very now. Disingenuous as far as how he's using that. He then states that, quote, Dawkins' quest to liberate Muslim women and smack them with a big old helping dose of George W. Bush's freedom. I mean, let me reread that. So, Dawkins' quest to liberate Muslim women and smack them with a big old heaping dose of George W. Bush's freedom. Where the hell did that come from?
And I can also point out that he's intentionally using emotional language, smack them with big old heaping dose. Like, you don't need to say smack there. You could have just said liberate Muslim women with freedom. Right?
Well, and, you know, he's tying in George W. Bush, which has a whole bunch of baggage with it.
Yeah.
Right? Again, this is where it's gone from, well, you may have a slight disagreement with some of the things he said, to where this has really become a hatchet job. I mean, and for the record, Dawkins has stated that the Iraq war was wrong and bizarre, and that to him it was pure racism or at least religious prejudice. So, I mean, he's in no way a supporter of George W. Bush. He doesn't believe in anything like that, whereas this strongly tries to tie him in with that whole sort of movement. And again, if we were talking about Harris, he might not be far off the mark, but he's not. He's talking about Dawkins.
Mm-hmm.
He then points out that Dawkins was upset when he believed mandatory segregation of the genders was being enforced. Well, Leon calls it the less offensive term, gender separate seating. But it was being enforced at a lecture that he was listening to. And then he goes on to say, well, Dawkins was not offended that when during a violin concert by Yitzhak Perlman in New York was segregated, or that Israeli Airlines, at least once, forced a reseating to accommodate
Orthodox
Jewish beliefs. right after that, he then states, well, Dawkins probably didn't know about that. It's kind of like he's sitting there saying, well, Dawkins has his radar, and he's just listening for any time a Muslim might be stepping out of bounds, and he leaps on him. But that ignores the fact that the first instance, was, they say, it was a religious debate. It had Lawrence Krauss in there, and he's friends with Lawrence Krauss. He was probably invited to the event. I'm sure if he was invited to the Perelman concert, he would have been just equally as upset by that. The article then slips even deeper into disgrace when he adds the line, quote, where exactly Dawkins gets his information about Islam is unclear. Perhaps Fox News, question mark. Again, an ad hominem attack. The fact, again, Dawkins is not a conservative from what I know. He seems more or less liberal in most of his views, right? So, again, this is just, it's a horrible hatchet job. He implies that Dawkins gives a full-throated endorsement of Geert Wilders' racist, bigoted views, and Geert Wilders is a very bad person, right? But he does quote Dawkins as saying, quote, with regards to the film Fatina, I salute you as a man of courage who has the balls to stand up to a monstrous enemy. Now, when I read that, I thought, well, balls doesn't sound like something Dawkins would say.
No.
So, thanks to the Wayback Machine, I found the actual quote where it comes from. And it was in a forum feed way down on the list. And what he ignored when he made this one quote was the part that came right before that. He said, Dawkins said, if it should turn out that you are a racist or gratuitous stir and provocateur, I withdraw my respect. So now Dawkins' comments were about Geert's film, Fatina, alone. And granted, that's not a complete absolution. The film itself has a lot of issues with it. But it's not like he was giving a full-throated endorsement of this Islamophobist, this hate person. Right. So I guess you can also say, and again, I feel a bit of an apologist, and I don't want to. I've mentioned lots in the show that I don't really believe in following people. You follow their ideas. So I'm not trying to deify Dawkins here. But he has been kind of a doddering old man at times in the past, where he's kind of confused his sort of anti-theist views with people who are nut jobs. And Bill Maher is the first one that jumps to mind.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, if anything, we've done a pretty good job on this show of, you know, digging into Dawkins when he does say stupid things. And goodness knows, he has said some really stupid things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's famous for his anti-feminist sort of quote.
Well, his dear Muslina comment. I mean, like, but the point is, like, this is the thing. If we're going to criticize Dawkins, and, you know, we should when he does say stupid things, we should get our facts straight. We don't want to end up with egg on our face. And I think that this article, you know, me and Don were talking about it before the show, and it's just like I was saying, his research was really poor. And Don was like, well, what research? Because, you know, I read this and I'm like going through this in my head, like, that's not true. That's not true. That's not true. You know, he's listing all these facts about new atheism, which is a nonsense term in the first place. If he had done any research, you would see that, like, nobody likes that word. No one likes calling themselves a new atheist, maybe except for Dawkins and Harris or something. But everyone else is like, you know, we've been doing atheism for like 40 years.
Yeah.
You know, they're not doing anything different than what we're doing. And it's just kind of a silly, silly piece. And it's really too bad because there are legitimate reasons to criticize Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris and everyone else. And we serve no purpose by making crap up like this.
Yes. Yes, I think you're right. You know, he does go on. He does say a few other things. You know, like Dawkins has criticized multiculturalism.
Hmm.
But he hasn't done it because he thinks everyone should be British. Maybe he does, but sometimes these terms can be used to mask what we consider to be bad behavior, in other words. So his comments were a direct comment about Muslim schools. And it's not that he hates Muslim schools per se, although any religious school is about that. But he's not a big fan of Catholic schools either. He's not a big fan of rabbinical schools. He's not in favor of private evangelical schools, right? So it's the idea that, you know, you're sending kids off to a religious school. That's his problem. Mm-hmm. But some people will use the term multiculturalism and say, no, 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 you can't complain about that because it's our culture. And that leads into the other interesting part that muddies the water is if your culture is also your religion. And in Muslims, you get a much mixing. You get the same sort of thing with Judaism and Jews, right? Where it's very hard to sort of separate the religion and the culture. and your religion tells you to do something horrible, I don't know, like cut off the genitalia of your daughter, right? Just to throw that one out there. And I say, no, that's wrong. Am I being a bigot, or am I being, you know, unthoughtful to your culture, or am I just being a sane person? You know, he criticizes Dawkins as saying, Dawkins at one point says, religion is the underlying source of divisiveness in the Middle East, which motivates us, motivates the use of deadly weapons in the first place. I hate to say it, but how is this not true? I mean, the major source of instability in the Middle East right now is Israel. By its own claims, it's a Jewish or religious state. Its major antagonist is in the region is Iran, also a religious state of the Islamic bent. So it's not like these are necessarily caused by religion, but religion is the manifestation.
Yeah,
it's the way it has manifested itself in these areas. And if you did not have that, we were talking before the show, there are sort of Arab Jews who have more in common with the Palestinians than they do the European Jews. And the only reason why they have an us and them dichotomy is this artificial thing called religion, which has been the source of so much violence in the region.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's unfortunate that this piece got sort of widely circulated as, like we were saying, there are lots of reasons to criticize Dawkins and Harris, and you know, this unfortunately gets them all wrong. We should write an actual article criticizing Dawkins and Harris on realistic points.
Well, we have criticized Harris more than once.
Yeah.
About something. I mean, he has.
Oh, yeah.
Of the, quote, four horsemen, he was probably the most egregious. Hitchens kind of apologized towards the end, saying, well, you know, I was really, really there. Now, maybe I was wrong. But, I mean, he was also someone who drank the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
I don't know why he makes a quick reference to Dennett, and I can't quite remember it now. But I'm going, who could be upset at Dennett?
Yeah, the guy barely says anything.
Yeah, he's like a slightly inflated version of James Randi.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's like kind of a doddering old man, big white beard, you know, hair and beard and the whole nine yards. You know, it's just like, how can you get upset? He's like a panda without the black eyes.
Well, let's take a quick commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
Do you enjoy these sounds? CITR is the home of amazing sounds. So listen to me always. 101.9 CITR.ca.
I will say B, Peru. I'll do it.
And that's your final answer?
Yes.
You could buy a new car. You just want
$33,055.78.
To everyone who donated to this year's fund drive, CITR would like to say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you to everyone who helped us meet and exceed our goal of $30,000. Your generous donations help us support local artists, businesses, and marginalized voices in the community. Here's to another 75 years of campus and community radio.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And Don, you know, today is April 2nd, which means we are finishing up our long weekend thanks to Easter. Did you have a nice long weekend Easter holiday?
I did, actually. I really had a long weekend for once. I work in retail, so sometimes that doesn't actually all that happen. And I spent most of my time looking for eggs in inappropriate places and didn't find any, but...
That's how it goes sometimes. You just don't find those eggs. So, you know, over the long weekend, people kept saying to me, Ethan, where does Easter come from? Okay, so actually no one said that to me, but it's a good way to introduce this conversation. Because I saw several different memes floating around the web regarding Easter. So, for example, the claim that Easter is based on the Ishtar holiday, the Assyrian and Babylonian goddess of fertility, or was it based on the Oster holiday, which is, I guess the E is silent, which is a spring-like fertility goddess and a feast day that was happening in early pagan Europe, which died out around the 8th century. Or is Easter just a Christian celebration of the resurrection of Jesus Christ?
When was the first Easter?
That's a good question. Another question here is, what about the Easter Bunny and the chocolate eggs? Where do they come from? What's going on with that? So, what does it all mean? And can we clear up some of these mysteries? So, first, I thought I should recap some of our thoughts on the subject of holidays and their origins. And we've gone through this with things like Halloween and Christmas, and Easter is no exception. So, these holidays are a combination of different cultures, different traditions, and they're spaced out over sometimes thousands of years. So if we look at our modern day holidays and the ways that we celebrate them, and then compare them to how they were celebrated, say, pre-1950s, and then again, how they were celebrated in the 1850s, and if you keep going back, you're going to notice some pretty significant changes. And this is because, well, I mean, a holiday is an amalgamation of the current trends and cultural influences of the day and age. So it's kind of difficult to say to a given holiday, where did this tradition come from? What was the first holiday? What is the origin? Where did these things come from? Because they have multiple different sources. It's a quilt of different ideas and theories, and you can't just pull out one strand and say, aha, there is the true source. So, that means we should be skeptical about the meaning of holidays, and I think we can start with Ishtar. So you may have seen this meme pop up on Facebook, ironically attached to the Richard Dawkins Foundation. I don't know what the connection was there. Maybe they were sharing a picture, or I don't know if someone there actually thought this was true.
Another one of his anti-Islamic
friends. Yeah, probably. But most of the claims in that meme are wrong. So I'll quickly run through them. The first one is, these are quotes from the picture. This is Ishtar pronounced Easter. No, it very much isn't. That is not how you pronounce Ishtar. You do not pronounce it as Easter. Another quote from the picture, Easter was originally the celebration of Ishtar, which is pure speculation and most likely wasn't. Ishtar, who is the, again, Assyrian Babylonian goddess of fertility, her symbols, like the egg and the bunny, were and still are fertility and sex symbols. They actually weren't her symbols. Her symbols were the lion, the gate, and the eight-pointed star. And another quote from the meme, after Constantine decided to Christianize the empire, Easter was changed to represent Jesus, which is also actually incorrect. At the Council of Nicaea, Easter was codified to separate it from the Jewish holiday of Passover, and more importantly, separate Christian holidays from the Jewish calendar. Anyway, back
to... When was the Council of Nicaea?
Council of Nicaea was, 325. That's right. Historian. Oh, yeah. But back to Ishtar, who was, in fact, the goddess of love, war, and sex, which just sounds pretty good.
Isn't that rock and roll?
That's kind of what rock and roll is all about. But anyway, if we wanted to compare Ishtar to another goddess, Venus or Aphrodite would be a better choice than a straight-up fertility goddess. Now, Ishtar, as far as I could tell, makes her first recorded appearance in the Epic of Gilgamesh around the 18th to 10th century BCE, depending on which version of Gilgamesh you use, which means that Ishtar was already about 2,000 years old around the time that Jesus was supposed to be around. And time is not a friend to gods. It's very unlikely that Ishtar was kept around in the public consciousness for that long a period without going some sort of metamorphosis into a totally different deity, right? So I think that it's fairly safe to say that we can rule out Ishtar as a direct descendant of Easter. So that leaves us with Ostar, or the pagan Germanic festival, which is spelled E-O-S-T-R-E. So I think maybe this is our smoking gun, because this was a goddess-slash-festival celebrating the return of spring and the end of winter. And most cultures mark the resurrection of spring on the calendar with some sort of feast or celebration. And that's called foreshadowing, by the way. So anyway, this was common in Northern Europe, and most of our knowledge comes from the Venerable Bede, a English monk who had an interest in finding the correct date for Easter. So going back to what I said earlier about how holidays are placed and celebrated, since it was very common for cultures to celebrate the return of spring, it's not surprising that the symbolism of Jesus being resurrected and the spring coincides with many other traditions where, you know, gods return to life, they bring in spring, they end winter, the whole rejuvenation stuff. That all makes sense, that we would associate that across cultures, not indicating that there was a causal relationship, but it just makes sense, right? So then is Ostar a slam dunk? Is this definitely the ancestor of Easter? Well, maybe. If we look at the word Easter in Latin and Hebrew, it's Pascha and Pesa, respectively. Easter is I'm gonna mispronounce these, so I apologize to everyone who's listening. Easter is Pasca in Italian, Pascu in Spanish, Pasque in French. Now, in English and German, it's Easter and Oster. Linguistically, they're descendants of Oster, whereas Easter is, in the other languages, are descended from Latin and Hebrew.
That's a coincidence.
That's interesting, isn't it? So what can we assume from this? My guess is that the Christian Easter and the pagan Easter are unrelated except in sharing symbolism and a relative time on the calendar. So after the Christianization of Europe, Christian Easter sort of absorbed the symbolism of Ostar, and that's how we sort of got the amalgamation here. But it wasn't. I don't think we could claim that it's an intentional conquest.
I would argue. I think it was an intentional conquest. One of the things that's almost ubiquitous, especially again with Christianity moving into Northern Europe area, is the hostile takeover of local religious sites, festivals, and changing them into Christian festivals. So, people sit there and they have Easter and they may have a festival, or Christmas they may have a winter festival or whatever. And you couldn't go in and you say, no, you must be austere like we are and suffer and just, not do anything. And people would say, oh, no, screw you. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go back with my old ones. Whereas they sit there and say, oh, no, you can keep all the fun stuff you like. But instead of saying that it's this pagan god you're doing to, let me give you, what really is going on. Is it that there was this Christian guy who died and he came back to life? Isn't that really kind of like what you guys are celebrating anyhow? And if you want to have the nice feast, sure, why not?
Well, that would be true, but Easter was already in existence by the time the Christianization of Northern Europe happened. It wasn't like they supplanted it. It was basically like you had two cultures that were both had a celebration on the same time period, and as one of them became more dominant, it sort of supplanted it, but it wasn't like a planned thing. It wasn't like they sat down and said, okay, the pagans are celebrating Ostar, so we're going to sneak in Easter. It was just sort of like...
Well, so maybe... I think that the original idea of Easter was more of a variation that the Jews have Passover. We want to have something like that, so we're going to have Easter. But the idea of the eggs and, there's the whole lead-up to Easter, I think they reworked from the pagan festivals from beforehand. I mean, again, 300 AD, there were Christians in Northern Europe at that time, and they were a minority.
Yeah, there weren't right? a lot of them, though.
So you're right. This isn't maybe quite as horrible as them going into something like... I'm trying to think of some holy site in Northern Europe where they put in a church, and the church they chose the location of the church because that also used to be the site for the river god or something, and that's more of an overt takeover, right? So you're right, there is a bit of shoehorning here. Which came first, the bunny or the egg, right?
Well, actually, though, Don, the interesting thing about the bunny, because I thought, like, when I was first researching this, I thought, that's got to be, like, an invention of, like, I don't know, Cadbury or something, you know? Like, there's no way that that was really a thing. But it turns out that rabbits were sort of viewed as symbols of fertility. I don't know why. But across cultures. In fact, an early Christian, like... I don't know, like paintings and murals, oftentimes you will see like a rabbit or a hare or something like that. And there is some evidence that rabbits were associated with the Norse god of Freya. And also we have evidence that indicates that like rabbits and bunnies and stuff like that were also associated with sort of the spring rejuvenation type festivals. So the thing with the rabbits... may have also been sort of a coincidence in that you had a common meme floating around the sort of European area that just kind of melded itself in together. Because it's a weird combination, rabbits and Jesus.
Well, you see, here's where, and again, I'm going to profess complete ignorance now.
Okay.
So people will write into us at
radiofreethinker.com,
So how prevalent were chickens in the north? I mean, it's a mainstay of the Mediterranean area, right? But then, how common are rabbits in the south? So I'm suspecting that you tend to get more rabbits in the open ranges of the north, and so the egg has symbolism. It has to. I mean, obviously, get a white rock and a bird comes out of it. I mean, how much more rebirth can you get from that?
Yeah.
But the idea of rabbits that live in warrens in the ground, and they come up and they come out from underneath. And I wonder how much of them hibernate.
I don't know, actually, too much. Look, keep in mind that we're also dealing with not just rabbits, but also hares. I think they're slightly different. But the connection there is interesting because as the Christian Easter started to spread throughout Europe, and started to sort of supplant the sort of fertility version of it, the bunny Moffat kept going. And in fact...
And going.
Yeah. But in fact, the first instance of a what we would call an Easter bunny is 16th century German literature, a sort of Lutheran interpretation of the bunny as bringing colored eggs to reward well-behaved children. And it's kind of like, it's almost like they're copying Saint Nick more than anything else. And it's an interesting trend. And getting back to sort of the question of Christianity sort of moving in for a holiday, if you look at the sort of the symbolism that goes along with Jesus, irregardless of whether or not there was a Jesus Christ, the whole story of his death, rebirth, resurrection is a common theme among Mediterranean gods, right? Like we know of like Osiris and these fellows. And if we go across cultures and examine other gods and other festivals, we see these same kind of themes repeating themselves. So I don't think it's out of the question that irrespective of a culture clash, we would still sort of see this play out.
Well, that's another thing I had problems with, too, thinking about it. And again, I'm not saying that Easter did not exist in sort of early Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole spring birth rite thing is a Northern European thing. I mean, the Mediterranean, you grow crops all year round. There is no springtime per se. I mean, yes, there are variations in the climate, but until you start getting to Northern Europe, until you start moving a fair ways, the whole Mediterranean area, you can grow crops all year round, right?
I don't know if that's entirely true, actually.
I would. And so, anyone out there.
Well, I mean, because you think about, like, Egypt, right? Like, I mean, you definitely have a growing season, you have a flood season, right? And that was part of the sort of lifeblood of the Nile Delta or whatever it was. And same with sort of like a lot of the sort of early civilizations would arise in floodplains where these played a major role in the season. So I think that you probably would have like growing seasons coinciding with the season. Way.
And again, you go up into the mountains. Like, I mean, you know, the mountainous area of Greece, you probably got snow. Mountainous area of Italy, you probably got snow.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Well, that's okay, Don. It's okay not to know sometimes. But anyway, that's my sort of take on the origin of Easter. As for the true meaning of Easter, I think I'm going to have to leave that to our listeners. But I don't know. The one thing that I didn't find was why chocolate came to symbolize, become the sort of dominant theme of Easter.
Coincidentally, which would have arrived around 16th century, period, at the time of the bunny.
Yeah.
Because, as we all know, chocolate only existed in the New World until they invaded and took over.
Well, the interesting thing is looking at some of the symbolism of the colored eggs. It's amazing, actually. There's so much research into what these things mean. And, for example, like the red eggs were supposed to symbolize the blood of Christ. And that in certain villages, you left around colored eggs year-round as sort of like good luck charms to ward off, you know, bad luck.
Well, and quite famously, I mean, eggs are known as part of black-white magic, right? Because, again, they're supposed to absorb evil spirits from whatever.
Yeah, and there were, like, all these things about, like, you can't wear a hat on Easter or something like that, or else you're inviting bad luck for the rest of the year. Weird little traditions that have gotten lost over time. I wish those would come back. Just because I think it's more interesting.
So next year I'm going to see you with an Easter bonnet.
Possibly, yes. Just, carrying around some bloody eggs.
That would be kind of gross because you can get bloody eggs, but we won't go there.
Yeah, let's not go there.
Okay.
Well, Don, before we go into our skeptical highlights, there was one other thing we wanted to discuss today.
Ready?
Yes.
Okay. This may be a little quick for some viewers, listeners as well. It's about the Korean War, Korean War Redux. If you have not been listening, it appears that North Korea and South Korea are in a state of war again. To be fair, they have been in a state of war ever since the North attempted to, quote, manually unify the Korean Peninsula in 1950. I say war, but definitions differ on who you are. The North Koreans see it as a liberating of their own people and territory. The South Koreans see it as, well, a war. The rest of the world, however, sees it as something unique. It's a police action. North Korea was charged with a, quote, breach of the peace, and member nations were asked to help restore the peace, of course, with their guns. It is unique in that it's one of the few times that the Security Council has authorized what most of us would call a war, especially when one of the belligerents was a strongly allied with the USSR, which is now called Russia, and which has a veto in the Security Council. This happened because the USSR was boycotting the council at the time in protest of Taiwan, which was given the China seat on the council. And of course, Taiwan is the island capitalist nation, and communist China, which the USSR was sort of supporting, was not given the seat. So the US managed to get the council to pass Resolution 82, and also at the same time ensuring that the USSR/Russia/China would be present for every council vote thereafter. Fool me once, ha ha, me, fool me twice, you know what I mean.
Right.
The Korean conflict, as those who watched the classic show MASH are familiar, had the North reduce the South to a few hundred kilometers. Then the UN force pushed back to the Chinese border, only to be repelled to south of the 48th parallel, where they eventually stabilized at about this 48th parallel, which is where it all began. Now, those of us who think that the war is old news, I mean, did it end in 1954? Well, yes and no. What happened in 1953 was an armistice, which is not a peace treaty, but an agreement to the cessation of hostilities. The idea, of course, is once you start firing at yourself, you can sit down and come up with a permanent solution, a sort of a long-term for real peace. Well, that's been like 60-plus years, and there's still no peace treaty. North Korea and South Korea are still technically at war. I say technically, but maybe a bit more than that. And this leads to a lot of the current headlines in today's news. The border between the two nations is a armed no man's land about 4 miles wide, with each side having thousands of troops ready to resume battle at any moment. Ironically enough, the KDMZ, or Korean Demilitarized Zone, has created one of the most important wildlife preserves because no one's allowed to live in the zone. Well, there's actually technically two exceptions, but there's no man's zone. So endangered creatures like the Korean leopard have found safe refuge in one of the oldest war fronts in the world. Okay, so besides the presence of military forces, the U.S. has also regularly held joint military exercises with the Korean military. From the South point of view, this is to ensure that the North will never sort of catch the South flat-footed like it did in 1950. Conversely, the North has seen the exercise as South's preparations for an attack on the North. The North has always sort of seen itself as the David of David and Goliath fame. Before the Vietnamese, the North Koreans stood up to the U.S. and the U.N. allies, and in its own eyes, it won. And it did this by being aggressive and showing the rest of the world that it couldn't be pushed around, or at least that's how they see it. There was a rocky warming of relationships between the North and South during the 1990s, but when in 2002, George W. Bush included North Korea as part of the, quote, axis of evil, well, needless to say, relationships kind of began a downward spiral. With the collapse of the USSR and the ever closer relationship between the US and China, North Korea figured it was about time to renew serious efforts to develop the ultimate deterrent for American provocations from its point of view, so it built the bomb. The U.S. has organized a global effort to impose sanctions on North Korea to stop its development of nuclear weapons, efforts, of course, which have failed. In the last few years, and especially in with the ascension of Kim Jong-un, there has been a ratcheting up of tensions between the North and the South. It is a common belief that North Korea is a backwards, poor, isolated nation ruled by a cadre of fanatical nutbags. Well, they may be many things, but they're not crazy. North Korea has managed to remain staunchly independent by using a very flexible, pragmatic, and at times Machiavellian diplomatic policy. The current leadership of Kim Jong-un has managed to consolidate his internal power while keeping both U.S. and Chinese sort of imperialists at bay. The U.S. has tried to cut North Korea off, but it's not actually that much of an isolated nation. North Korea has a large disparity between its urban and rural populations, and farmers still on occasion will suffer starvation because of lack of resources, but this has become quite rare. They had a horrible time in the 1990s, in the middle of the century, huge starvation, but they've really sort of fixed most of the innate problems they had there. Plus, food shortages become much less when half of your population dies on you, so that's also kind of ironically helped the situation. That said, North Korea has a higher GDP than Nicaragua, Nigeria, Bahama, Kenya, Cambodia. I mean, don't get me wrong, when you compare it to Canada or South Korea, their economy is nothing. But considering the international sanctions, one has to be actually kind of impressed at how well they're doing. Now, it's not that China's propping it up either. A constant refrain is that North Korea is isolated and must lock in its people, ignores the fact that thousands of Koreans travel to China and Mongolia to work in factories. Others work in Russia lumber industry. Kuwait hires them for major construction projects. Right now, North Koreans are building the visitors pavilion at Angkor Wat in Cambodia. Part of the project includes a 3D interactive attraction that leads me to mention one of the other things North Korea has gained a favorable reputation for is in computer programming. Pyongyang is the center of an information technology sector that is an outsourcing destination of other countries, even developing software and apps for like the iPhone. They're still famous for their animation. If you don't believe me, check out The Simpsons. There's proof in there. It's also important that from one day, North Korea believes... Well, from day one, it's always believed in this idea of self-reliance. You know, it needs to only rely on itself. So it tries to supply its own needs. So it's actually really impervious to sanctions that try and cut us. I mean, Canada would be starved to death if we didn't have any imports from other countries. But North Korea has tried very much to become very, very much self-reliant, and with the exception of when there are natural disasters, it works well. Of course, when there are natural disasters, they suffer a lot more because they only have them to rely upon. The flip side of the coin, of course, let's skip the flip side. Of course, some have assumed that China could just sort of snap its fingers and North Korea would, I don't know, apparently do whatever it wants. The apparent this is not quite really what happens too. North Korea has done a remarkable job of sort of squaring the circle. It has played Russia off against China, against America, in sort of keeping everyone at bay, and while trying to do that, they've maintained a very strong sense of independence. So, once again, North Korea has been playing this game for a long time, and it knows how to play one side off against the other. It uses the insecurities of its local neighbors in order to maintain its own sort of sense of stability, especially China, which is worried that, you know, any form of instability in the region is going to be bad for business. So it's much more willing to sort of bend over backwards for North Korea, if only it could get North Korea to sort of shut up. In its own eyes, you know, North Korea sits back and says, listen, we've defeated the superpower, the U.S., they've kowtowed China. They feel very much, you know, very independent, very strong, but they also feel that, you know, they're in a corner, that if they don't sort of keep up with this loudness, that they've got enemies on all sides. So I guess sort of the last word I'm going to mention is, should we be afraid of North Korea? As Canadians, no. Although they brag they have rockets that could hit the lower 48 states, evidence shows that the technology they have could barely reach the U.S. and, of course, accidentally hit Canadians, because we're only worried about Canadians, and that the tech would be limited in number and probably easily shot down if they ever did that sort of thing. If I was a Korean, well, I'm not that, you know, I'd shit my pants. I would be much, much more nervous. And even if I was Japanese, because for them, if I don't think Pyongyang wants war, but they keep playing chicken, and sometimes you get hit when you play chicken.
Well, the battlefield, if there ever was a war, would be in Asia.
Well, and that's it. So North Korea, I mean, it does have nuclear weapons. They might not be able to reach the United States, but they definitely can hit Seoul, and they probably can hit parts of Japan. North Korea has a military of over 1 million people, with reserves that number above 8 million. So if it wanted to smother South Korea, it does have the manpower. North Korea has a large army itself. South Korea has a large army itself and much more advanced weapons. So although outnumbered, they might be able to hold off the North Koreans. And we don't know. Maybe the North Korean army might be like Saddam Hussein's and more of a paper tiger than a real one. But who wants to prove that? The nightmare scenario is if North Korea does launch a surprise attack with U.S. surveillance tech. I'm unsure how this could actually happen, but let's pretend it did. And like in 1950, they managed to swamp South Korea, but this time right to Incheon, right to the borders, and they take over the country sort of in a day. The North installs a puppet government in the South and either surrenders or calls for unification. Of course, the rest of the world would condemn this action, but there would be no sort of UN Security Council resolution because Russia or China would veto it. The U.S. wouldn't actually be able to come to the rescue if not so much, you know, if the South was lost. It's involved in three wars already, right? It's got this global war on terror. It just doesn't really have the resources to put troops on the ground. China will become increasingly... China would welcome the increased stability of a unified Korea that it would offer. And depending on how North Korea deals with the South, if it's sort of like Israel and bleeds it to submission, sort of like how they do with the Palestinians, that's probably not a bad thing. But if it does what China did with Hong Kong, where it kind of gives it enough rope until it sort of hogties itself out into submission, then maybe the world would say, eh. I found it really interesting because when I was doing my research for this, there was a picture of a person taking a photo of a North Korean filming him taking the photo. So it's kind of meta. But I noticed in his hand was a modern, up-to-date Sony camcorder, which is, I mean, if you're supposed to be such a backwards country, how do you still have a lot of this stuff that's supposed to be taken out?
Well, I guess time will only tell if hostilities break out in the Koreas, but let us hope that, you know, that is not the case.
Yes.
Anyway, let's go to our skeptical highlights as we are running out of time here on Radio Free Thinker. My skeptical highlights, I have two of them this week. The first one is a skeptics in the pub, but not just your average skeptic in the pub. This skeptics in the pub includes a skeptical pub quiz smackdown happening Tuesday, April 16th at 7:30 p.m.
Minus 1 point for Ethan.
Shut up. At 7:30 p.m. at the Railway Club, downtown Vancouver. So this is following in the great tradition of the Canadian Skeptical Pub Quiz Smackdown, we've created a news pub quiz, and assemble your team of four smarty pants, and we will see who takes the mantle of skeptic know-it-all. And you can find out all that information on VancouverSkeptics.org or on Facebook or any other place. We'll have links to it on the show notes. Now, my next skeptical highlight is actually quite important. CFI Canada has finally heard back from the new Office of Religious Freedom and has set up a meeting on Thursday, April 4th with the ambassador to discuss secular issues. CFI wants to hear from you on what important points we need them to bring up. So let CFI know cases of atheist persecution or other freedom from religion points. You can contact CFI. You can tweet them at CFI Canada. Use the hashtag atheistORF. You can email them at feedback@CFICanada.ca, or you can post to the Facebook meetup groups. This is really important. I shouldn't have to say this to any of our listeners, because we all know this is really important. If we want Canada to develop a reputation for defending not just religious freedom, but freedom from religion, we need this Office of Religious Freedom to recognize the importance of secularism and atheists out there.
I agree. And, you know, stand up and be counted.
Absolutely.
I have one quickie, just a warning. Sylvia Brown is coming to town. Run away. She's in Coquitlam this Friday, 8 p.m. Please don't go. Please don't see her. If you have any Easter eggs that might be a little rotten, I'm not saying you should throw them, but, hey, accidents happen. So, Ethan, this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
This is Ethan saying, thanks for listening, and see you next week.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning.